Her smile was so gentle, so unaffected, that his chest squeezed again, and his voice sounded choked in his own ears. "I'm leaving tomorrow."
"Yes," Selina nodded. "We shall miss you dreadfully."
"This is the first chance I've had to speak to you alone, without the monsters."
"Oh, Ralph, that's unkind. It's totally accurate, of course. Description of my darling sisters."
Her laughter had a surprising timbre and depth to it.
"If you wanted to speak to me, you should have asked."
"I'm asking now, Selina."
"And we are alone?"
"Will you not stop still for a moment?"
"The baking will spoil, but I can listen well enough while I work."
Ralph shifted his feet and hunched his shoulders uncertainly. It was not as he had planned it. It was going to be a feat of timing and dexterity to sweep her up in arms all covered with flour and dough and with a heavy rolling pin clutched in her hands. "Selina, you are the most beautiful lady, that I have ever seen."
"That's kind but untrue, Ralph. I do have a mirror, you know."
"It's true, I swear."
"Oh, please don't swear, Ralph. In any event, there are much more important things in life than physical beauty. Kindness and goodness and understanding, for instance."
"Oh, yes, and you have all those." Suddenly Selina stopped in mid-stroke, and she stared at him with an expression of dawning consternation.
"Ralph," she whispered. "Cousin Ralph."
"Cousin I may be," he was stammering slightly in his rush to have it all said. "But I love you, Selina. I loved you from the first moment I saw you at the river."
"Oh, Ralph, my poor dear Ralph." Consternation was mingled now with compassion.
"I would never have spoken. Not before, but now, after this expedition, I have some substance. I'll be able to pay off my debts, and when I come back I'll have my own wagons. I'm not yet rich, but I will be."
"If only I'd known. Oh, Ralph, if only I'd suspected, I would have been able to..."
But he was gabbling it out now. "I love you, Selina. Oh, how dearly I love you, and I want you to marry me." She came to him then, and her eyes filled with blue tears that trembled on her lower lids.
"Oh, dear Ralph, I'm so sorry. I would have given anything to save you from hurt. If only I'd known..."
He stopped then, bewildered. You will not? Does that mean you will not marry me?" The bewilderment faded, and his jaw thrust out and his mouth hardened. "But why not? I'll give you everything. I will cherish and..."
"Ralph..."
She touched his lips and left a little dab of flour upon them.
"Hush, Ralph, hush."
"But, Selina, I love you, don't you understand?"
"Yes, I do, but, dear Ralph, I don't love you."
Kathy and the twins went as far as the river with Ralph. Vicky and Lizzie rode, two up, on Tom's back. They rode astride with their skirts up around their thighs and squealed with delight every few seconds, until Ralph thought his eardrums would split, and he scowled moodily ahead, not replying to Kathy's questions and comments as she skipped along beside him, until the spring went out of her step and she too fell silent. The bank of the Kami River was where they would part. All of them knew that, without speaking about it. And when they reached it, Itsasi had already taken the wagon through the drift. The iron-shod wheels had left deep scars in the far bank. He would be an hour or so ahead. They stopped on the near bank, and now even the twins were silent. Ralph looked back along the track, lifting his hat and shading his eyes with the brim against the early sunlight. "Selina isn't coming, then?" he said flatly.
"She's got a bellyache," said Vicky. "She told me so." "If you ask me, it's more like the curse of Eve," said Lizzie airily. "That's rude," Kathy said, "and only silly little girls talk about things they don't understand."
Lizzie looked chastened, and Vicky assumed a virtuous air of innocence.
"Now both of you say goodbye to Cousin Ralph." "I love you, Cousin Ralph," said Vicky, and had to be prized off him like a leech. "I love you, Cousin Ralph."
Lizzie had counted the kisses that Vicky had bestowed on him, and she went for a new world record. A noble attempt, but frustrated by Kathy.
"Now scat,"
Kathy told them.
"Go, both of you."
"Kathy's crying," said Lizzie,
and both twins were immediately entranced.
"I am not," said Kathy furiously.
"Oh, yes, you are," said Vicky.
"I have something in my eye."
"Both eyes?" asked Lizzie sceptically.
"I warn you," Kathy told them.
They knew that expression of old, and reluctantly they retired just out of range. Kathy turned her back to them, so they missed half of what followed.
"They're right."
Her whisper was as blurred as her eyes.
"I am crying, Ralph. I hate so to see you go."
Ralph had not truly looked at her. Not ever. His eyes had been for Selina alone. But now her frank admission touched him, and he saw her for the first time. He had thought her a child, but he had been wrong. He realized this suddenly. It was the thick, dark eyebrows and the firm chin that gave strength to her face, so that he sensed that anything that made her cry was deeply felt. Surely she had not been so tall when first he met her, almost a year before. Now the top of her head reached his chin. The freckles on her cheeks kept her young, but her nose was set in the shape of maturity, and the gaze of her green eyes, below the arched brows, though flooded now with tears, was too wise and steady for childhood. She still wore the muddy green dress of sewn flour sacks, but its fit had altered. Now it was baggy at the waist, while at the same time it was too tight across her chest. Yet it could not suppress the thrust of young, firm breasts, and the seams strained across hips that he remembered being as narrow and bony as a boy's.
"You will come back, Ralph. Unless you promise, I cannot let you go."
"I promise," he said. And suddenly the pain of rejection by Selina, which he had thought might destroy him, was just supportable.
"I will pray for you each day until you do," Kathy said, and came to kiss him.
She no longer felt skinny and awkward in his arms, and Ralph was suddenly very aware of the softness of her against his chest, and lower. Her mouth had a taste like chewing a stalk of green spring grass. Her lips formed a pillow for his. He had no burning desire to break the embrace, and Kathy also seemed content to let it persist. The pain of unrequited love ebbed a little more to be replaced by a warm and comforting sensation, a most pleasant glow, until with a shock Ralph realized two things. Firstly, the twins were an avid audience, their eyes enormous and their grins impudent. Secondly, that the pleasant glow which had suffused him had its source considerably lower than his broken heart, and was accompanied by more tangible changes that must soon become apparent to the fresh young innocent in his arms. He almost shoved her away, and vaulted up onto Tom's back with unnecessary violence. However, when he looked down at Kathy again, the tide of green tears in her eyes had receded and been replaced by a look of satisfaction, a knowingness that proved beyond doubt what he had just come to realize, that she was no longer a child.
"How long?" she asked.
"Not before the end of the rains," he told her. 6 or 7 months from now." And suddenly that seemed to Ralph to be a very long time indeed.
"Anyway," she said, "I have your promise."
On the far bank of the river he looked back. The twins had lost interest and started home. They were racing each other down the track, skirts and plaits flying. But Kathy still stood staring after him. Now she lifted her hand and waved. She kept waving until horse and rider disappeared amongst the trees. Then she sat down on a log beside the track. The sun made its noon and then sank into the misty smoke of the bushfires that blued the horizon and turned to a soft red orb that she could look at directly without paining her eyes. In the gloaming, a leopard soared and hacked harshly from the dense, dark riverine forest nearby. Kathy shivered and stood up. She cast one last lingering glance across the wide riverbed, and then at last she turned for home. Butzo could not sleep. Hours ago he had left his sleeping mat and come to squat by the fire in the centre of the hut. The others had not even stirred when he moved. Zama and Kamuza and Mondani, those who would accompany him tomorrow. Their finery was piled beside their recumbent figures, the cloaks of feathers and furs and beads, the headdresses and kilts, the regalia reserved for only the most grave and momentous occasions, like the festival of the first fruits or a personal report to the king. or again the ceremony for which they had gathered and which would start at the dawn of the morrow. Bazzo looked at them now, and his chest felt congested with his joy, joy so intense that it sang in his ears and fizzed in his blood, joy even more intense in that these, his companions of the years, with whom he had shared boyhood and youth and now manhood, would be there again at one of the most important days of his life. Now Bazzo sat alone at the fire, while his companions snored and muttered in sleep, and he took each coin of his good fortune, and like a miser counting his treasure, fondled it with his mind, turning each memory over and gloating upon it. He lived again every moment of his triumph, when the lines of captive women had filed before Lobengula, and piled the spoils in front of his wagon, the bars and coils of red copper, the axe heads, the leather bags of salt, the clay pots full of beads, for Pemba had been a famous wizard, and had gathered his tribute from a host of fearful clients. Lobengula had smiled when he saw his treasure, for that was what had been at the root of his feud with Pemba. The king was not above the jealousies of common men. When Lobengula smiled, all his Indunas smiled in sympathy and made those little clucking sounds of approval. Bazzo remembered how the king had called him forward, and smiled again when Bazzo emptied the bag he carried over his shoulder, and the wizard's head, which by then was in an advanced state of decomposition, had rolled to the forewheel of the wagon and grinned up at Lobengula with ruined lips drawn back from uneven teeth stained by the hemp pipe. A troop of the gaunt, mange-ridden pariah dogs that skulked about the king's kraal had come to snarl and squabble over the morsel, and when one of the black-cloaked executioners would have scattered them with blows of his knobkerry, the king restrained him. "Eh, the poor beasts are hungry. Let them be." And he turned back to Bazzo. "Tell me how it was done." Bazzo relived in his mind every word with which he had described the expedition, and while he told it, he began to gia, to dance and sing the ode to Pemba, which he had composed. "Like a mole in the earth's gut, Bazzo found the secret way," he sang, and in the front row of the senior Ndunas, Gandang, his father, sat grave and proud. "Like the blind catfish that live in the caves of Sinoya, Bazzo swam through darkness." Then, as the verses of the song mentioned them, Zama and his warriors sprang forward to whirl and dance at his side. "Like the black mamba from under a stone, Zama milked death from his silver fang." When the triumph dance was over, they threw themselves face down on the earth in front of the wagon. "Bazzo, son of Gandang, go out and choose 200 head from the royal herds," said Lobengula. "Bayeti," shouted Bazzo, still panting from the dance. "Bazzo, son of Gandang, you who commanded 50 so skillfully, now I give you 1,000 to command. Inkosi, Lord, you will command the levy of young men waiting now at the royal kraal on the Shangani River. I give you the insignia for your new regiment. Your shields will be red, your kilts the tails of the jennet cat, your plumes the wing feathers of the marabou stork, and your headband the fur of the burrowing mole." Lobengula intoned and then paused. "The name of your regiment will be Izim Vukuzani Ezembintaba, the moles that burrow under a mountain." "Nkosi Kahula, great king," Bazzo roared. "Now, Bazzo, rise up and go into the women. To choose yourself a wife, be sure that she is virtuous and fruitful, and let her first duty be to set the headring of the Induna on your brow." "Inklovo, Ngeabong, great elephant, I praise you." Sitting his solitary watch by the fire, Bazzo remembered every word, every change of tone, every pause and emphasis that the king had used to heap his honours upon him. He sighed with contentment and placed another log upon the fire, careful so as not to wake his companions, and the sparks floated up through the opening in the highest point of the domed roof. Then a distant sound interrupted his reverie. It was the single whoop of a hyena. Not an unusual sound, except that it was the first time that he had heard it since nightfall. On every other night, the hideous cries of these loathsome animals began when they crept from their burrows at dusk and continued until sunrise. They haunted the small woody copse beyond the cattle enclosure that all the inhabitants of Gundung's kraal used as a communal open-air latrine. The hyena cleansed the area of excrement during the hours of darkness. For this reason, Gundung's people tolerated the presence of an animal that they usually abhorred with a superstitious dread. So tonight the single whooping cry at midnight drew attention to the silence that had preceded it. Butzo listened a few seconds longer and then let his thoughts stray to the morrow. After the king, Gundung was one of the three most important personages in Matabeleland. Only Somabula and Babian were his peers, so that a marriage at his kraal would have been a momentous event, even if it were not his eldest son, himself a newly appointed Induna of 1,000, who was to be the bridegroom. Juba, senior wife of Gundung and mother of Butzo, the bridegroom, had supervised the brew of beer, watching with an expert eye for the bloom of yeast on the germinating sorghum, testing with her own plump finger the temperature of the ground meal gruel as it was malted, judging the addition of the final booster of yeast, and then standing over the matrons as they strained the brewing through woven bamboo sieves into the huge black clay beer pots. Now there were 1,000 pots, each holding half a gallon of her famous brew, ready to greet the guests as they arrived at Gundung's kraal. There would be 1,000 invited guests. Lobengula and his retinue were already on the road. They were sleeping tonight at the regimental kraal of the Intemba regiment, only 5 miles distant, and they would arrive before noon. Somabula was with the king, while Babian was coming in from his kraal in the east with 100 warriors in his bodyguard. Nomusa and Hlopi were coming from the mission station at Kami as Juba's special guests, and they were bringing all their daughters with them. Gundung had picked 50 fat bullocks from his herds, and the bridegroom and his young companions would begin to slaughter and butcher them in the dawn, while the unmarried girls took the bride down to the river pool, bathed her, and then anointed her with fat and clay until she glistened in the early sunlight. Then they would deck her with wild flowers. The hyena called again, much closer this time, sounding as if it were right outside the stockade. And then a strange thing happened. The single cry was answered by a chorus, as though a great multitude of the huge, shaggy, spotted, dog-like beasts had surrounded Gundung's kraal. Butzo started up from the fire in astonishment. He had never heard anything to equal this. There must be 100 or more of the ungainly animals out there. He could imagine them, their high shoulders sloping down to meagre hindquarters, the flat snake-like heads held low as though the weight of massive underslung jaw and yellow carnassial teeth were too heavy for the neck. 100 at least. He could almost smell their breath as they opened those iron jaws, capable of crunching the thigh bone of bull buffalo to splinters. They would reek of long-dead carrion and excrement and other filth. But it was the sound of their voices that chilled Butzo's guts and started the march of ghost feet along his spine. It was as though all the souls of the dead had risen from their graves to clamour outside Gundung's stockade. They whooped and howled, beginning in a low moan and rising sharply in key. Awoo! They shrieked like the ghost of a Mashona, feeling again the steel cleave his breast, and the terrible cries woke the echoes amongst the kopjes along the river. Almost humanly they giggled, and they laughed, that maniacal and mirthless laughter. The peals of fiendish laughter mingled with the tormented shrieks, and then with them were the cries of the kraal's watchmen, the screeches of the waking women in their huts, the shouts of the men still half asleep as they scrambled for their weapons. "Do not go out!" Kamuza shouted across the hut, as Butzo sprung to the door with his shield on his shoulder and his assegai in his right hand. "Do not go into the dark. This is a witchcraft. Those are not animals out there.